Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, it's Yakub Zaki and Marek the Verger at the Lord Mayor's Chapel, just opposite the City Hall here in Bristol at College Green. And they'll be talking about a unique bit of architecture in there. That's the 16th century Islamic tiles. Yakub Zaki is author of The Legacy of Muslim Spain, 1994. I bet you didn't know that there were tiles brought over around about the time of the dissolution of the monasteries from Spain, built by Muslims, and they're there in Bristol. Well, they're very unique. So they take us through it, Marek Barden and Yakub Zaki. Also, Carol Higgins, she's the author of Conquering the Impossible, Making the Dream Come True, 2015. Well, it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's not. It's a talk about her battle, both with cancer and with being sexually abused as a child, and her battle for justice. She sees it as conquering a mountain. Also, John Langley, he stood against Marvin Rees in last year's mayoral election, and he's been picking up gossip in Bedminster about a place called the Crystal Dove, where Marvin Rees, who won the election's father, used to run. It was a nightclub in St Paul's, that's Valentine Rees. Apparently, Marvin's father, according to John, was the biggest gangster in Bristol. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street, and I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
Why don't you come in?
This is, I think, a chantry chapel for the man who founded it and who was originally buried here in the middle of the floor. And his tomb collapsed in the 18th century and the floor fell into the vault. But you can see there's a combination of Christian and Islamic tiles. The Islamic ones are the ones with the geometrical patterns on them, and the Christian ones have Renaissance patterns, and they all juxtapose, higgledy-piggledy. It's very confused. But it shows that there was some connection between Bristol and Seville in the 16th century, or perhaps even earlier. When I first heard about these tiles, I thought the connection must be through the wine trade with Portugal, but no, it's not. The tiles came from Seville, which was the capital of the Sultanate of Seville in the 11th and 12th centuries. But these tiles are later. They are 16th century, and a type called cuerda seca, which means dry cord, because the colours are separated by a line of manganese, which vaporises in the kiln, but keeps the colours separate and prevents them running into each other.
Now, what you say that there's a big difference between the patterns. For me, they were kind of circular, almost like kind of rose petal style, and also some of them are more rectangular. So which is which?
Well, this is a typical Islamic pattern here. You can see it's based on axes of symmetry, which if the floor had been properly laid and were exclusively Islamic, these axes of symmetry would extend out to cover the entire floor. Because the great thing about Islamic art is if only a fragment of it survive, from that you can reconstruct the whole. Because the Arabs were the masters of mathematics in the Middle Ages. And by extending these axes of symmetry, which subsequently intersect, it would form a complete pattern covering the entire floor. But the floor was, in fact, laid to decorate the tomb of his father by the son of this man, whose funerary chapel this was. And he was doing business with Spain, and he purchased these tiles indiscriminately in Seville, which thus it's a mixture of Christian, that is Renaissance patterns, and Islamic. So it's not as good as a visit to the Alhambra, but it does give you some idea. However, in the Alhambra, the tiles are much higher quality in this because they are tile mosaic. You have to realise each pigment has its its optimum firing point in the kiln at which it yields its maximum brilliance. So the only way to do this properly is to cut it out, each one, in little pieces of mosaic and piece it together. It's what you'll find in the Alhambra, with very complex patterns indeed. But when it's done on a square tile, intended to be juxtaposed with other tiles with a continuous pattern linking them all, then they would use this other technique called cuerda seca, which of course doesn't produce the same brilliance as tile mosaic.
We're here with you, the verger, here in the Norbert's Chapel. How come it looks as if you've had to roll this carpet back? Why is that?
We leave it permanently rolled back so that people can see the floor. Now we have the barrier around it. Before we had a barrier here, it had to be permanently covered with a carpet to protect it so that this part of the building could be used. So if we ever have a service here, we'll roll the carpet back so we can use it. And when it's open to visitors, it's rolled as it is now.
Do many Muslims come here to Bristol to see these tiles?
Not many Muslims come in here, no, but we get other visitors from all over the world that come to see the tiles, yeah. Including visitors last year from the Kremlin museums in Russia, who came specifically to see them.
But what were they interested in? Why?
I think it's because they are reputedly one of the largest quantities of 16th century tiles from Spain in England. They're not common in this country, and they'd just heard of that reputation through the Victoria and Albert Museum, where some of the tiles are present.
Okay, so if the tiles are from 16th century Spain, there may be a bit of a dispute about whether they really are Islamic tiles or not, because, you know, obviously it wasn't completely Islamic,
no. And
there was a dispute. I mean, there was a Christian and the Muslims were fighting in Spain.
It was the Islamic style of patterning, though, did continue for quite a long time after the change of rule in Spain, with so the Moorish influence going, the Sultanates going, and the new Spanish monarchy coming back, Ferdinand and Isabella. The connection here as well with Spain is also that Robert Poins, whose chantry chapel this is, was one of Catherine of Aragon's household. He was her chancellor.
Yeah.
It's always
outside Bristol,
yes,
I think. Yes, mm-hmm. And there is the coat of arms there of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon.
It's actually up there as well,
it's on the roof.
Mm-hmm. And there's the coat of arms of Robert Poins himself.
So is that true? At some point, this floor completely collapsed?
We're not entirely sure which bit collapsed. We know in the 1730s the weight of the tomb collapsed into the vault below. We're not entirely sure whether it was in the middle or whether it was in these two alcoves, which is more likely.
Yes.
Because those are Georgian tiles, and from the 1730s to the 1880s, that was actually the city archive store. It had doors on it. It's unlikely that the tomb was in the middle here, because there are too many tiles and they wouldn't have been underneath it. Mm-hmm. The tomb was here first.
Well, hang on, you can't fit the city archive in those two little alcoves.
You could in those days. The archives were a lot smaller than they are now. It was only important documents.
You've got a massive vault for them all.
Yes.
Is there room for a body in here?
The bodies are actually below. In the vault.
It would
just have been a monument tomb.
I see.
So we have both ends, or
you've
both, both coats of arms.
Two ends with this coat of arms. Yeah, that's Gothic. But these tiles are 16th century, aren't they?
Yes.
See, Seville fell to the Christians in 1248, 12 years after the fall of Cordoba, which fell in 1236. But the Moorish workmen continued because the Christian artisans didn't have these skills. So they used Muslim architects to design even their churches, called mudéjar. And also this kind of tile work continued right on into the 16th century. And indeed, in Manises, which is near Valencia, they still make the ceramics in the Islamic style. And there are two people in Granada who have revived the art of Islamic ceramics. One of them makes copies of the Alhambra vase. But as I said to the other one, who is a convert to Islam, I said, "Su oro es fangoso," his gold is muddy. And he said, "Yes, it is." But he is nevertheless a very skilled artist. There's a whole museum in Hun, which used to be a separate municipality from Granada, but now it's just a suburb. And he has this private museum, and it's worth a visit, because he makes exact copies of the different. There wasn't just one Alhambra vase. There were a whole lot in various museums, and he makes copies of them, but also he makes modern interpretations of the style, which are very good and very convincing. The other one who does this makes tile work, which you can, in fact, the Muslims here were better educated. They will go there and order the tiles for their mosques. Instead, they don't. So I'm not surprised when you said not many Muslims come to see this.
Now, you call them Muslim tiles or Islamic tiles, but actually, surely they are in an Islamic style actually made by Christians.
Oh, no. They wouldn't have the skill to do a tile as brilliant as that. In the Middle Ages, the Christians were just a peasantry, uneducated and crude. And on top, there was a military aristocracy, which employed Muslim because they were so much better at the job.
This particular chapel, what happens in here now?
It's used occasionally for communion services, and if we ever have a wedding or a blessing of marriage, they sign the registers in here. Other than that, it's just open for visitors to come and see, to admire the tiles, to admire the beautiful Tudor architecture, and some of the part of the collection of the glass that we have in the chapel.
Interesting that the people from the Kremlin should take an interest in it, but what was the point, really?
I think they wanted to see this kind of tile in England. They must have some kind of tile exhibition themselves, and they are quite world-renowned, in a way. So we do get visitors from all over the world that have heard of these tiles.
You've also got something else a bit unique about the Lord Mayor's Chapel, haven't you, in that it's the only church, I think, in the country which is managed by a city council.
It is the only church that's certainly owned and operated as a church by a city council. Many city councils own redundant churches, but they're used for other things. But this functions as a civic church for the city.
And what sort of civic events take place in here? And how, is it actually used very much?
It's used every Sunday for congregational worship on Sunday mornings. We have a civic service once a year and other services that the Lord Mayor attends. And it's also used as a venue for concerts and other events.
It's also very handy for the council house. If any of those city councillors or officers feel the need to confess their sins or whatever, they might come across the road.
If they want to come across the road and get a bit of peace and sit down here and commune with God, they're very welcome to do so. And we sometimes do get people drifting across from the council house into here.
So when's it open?
It's open Wednesday to Saturday throughout the year and on Sunday mornings for worship.
And we have two stories about this, these tiles that will interest you, I think. Back in the 70s, the only comprehensive organisation of Muslims in Britain was UMO, Union of Muslim Organisations of Great Britain and ERA. In addition to their AGM, which was held in London, they would hold regional meetings, and they decided to hold one here in Bristol. And I had to give a speech. And I said that Bristol has a long connection of history with Islam. And I referred to these tiles. Now, the mayor was sitting there on the platform. Of course, I didn't see his face because I was also on the podium. But somebody who did said you should have seen his face at that moment because he said, I don't think he knew it until you spoke about it. But the other story is equally interesting. Some friends of mine living near here in Bristol, the husband was the head of agriculture for southern England, and they lived in a farm outside Bristol. When they came back from Tehran, where he had been the agricultural attaché, and his wife had converted to Islam there following an accident, but he had not. He was always prepared to convert, but he said he wouldn't give up the bottle, and she wouldn't have that. So they occupied separate bedrooms. But according to the legal school to which she belongs, since she had converted in Iran, it's called the Jafari school, since intermarriage is permitted for men but not for women, the question arises, what when a wife married to a non-Muslim man, what does she do if she converts? And she is given, I think it's 3 months in which to convert him, whereafter her conversion becomes invalid. So she kept repeating it every three months, but she wouldn't sleep with them. They occupied separate bedrooms. And eventually they separated, and I got a job in my office in London in the Muslim Institute. However, when I was staying with them at their farm outside Bristol, I said to her, have you seen the tiles in this church? No, they had only recently got back from Tehran. And so I took her here, and she was so charmed, she took down the pattern of one of them and made it into a cushion. I presume she still has that cushion. The husband is dead, but she's very much alive and still has the cushion. The circumstances of her conversion were extremely interesting. The husband was the agricultural attaché in the British Embassy, and an agricultural attaché doesn't spend much time in the embassy. Usually he's touring, you know, examining pump installations and new varieties of seed and things like that. So one day he was driving too fast on a mountain road outside Isfahan, the ancient capital of Iran, and the car somersaulted and turned over. They were both knocked unconscious, but he came to very quickly. Her life was despaired of. However, some peasants who had been nearby heard the noise of the crash, and they extracted them from the wreckage, and they were taken to a hospital in Isfahan. She was still in a coma, but they operated on her. And the first thing that she heard when she opened her eyes, when she came out from the anaesthetic, was, Alhamdulillah, God be praised. And she looked around the room, and there were all those pious Muslim women who had been praying for her from the moment she entered the hospital, and she didn't know about this. And she believed it was their intercession. I don't know how to... Well, the English translation is intercession. In Arabic, it's shafa'a. It means there are certain privileged individuals, particularly saints, that if you intercede with them, they carry your prayer to God. Or in this case, I think it was the eighth imam, because he's the only one of the 12 imams of Shiism buried in Iran. The rest are in Iraq mostly, but one of them is in Saudi Arabia. At any rate, these women had been interceding with the eighth imam for her recovery. And she attributed her recovery to that, because, in fact, her life was despaired of. And she's missing two vertebrae in the spine, because the impact of the crash, the two vertebrae were crushed to powder. So her own life history is very interesting, and the association with these tiles.
These tiles are a classic example of a crossing over of two different cultures as well in their styles, I think.
Yeah.
In Spain.
Yeah. I think the son of the man who was buried here he didn't know anything about Islamic art, but he was just attracted by the colourful nature, which must have been much brighter at that time. And he just bought any tiles and assembled them here, higgledy-piggledy.
Well, when the floor was originally laid, I gather it was laid more symmetrically, but from 1732 to 1888, this was used as the clerk's vestry. And they dragged a lot of furniture all over the floor, and there was a fireplace in here as well, and they damaged them. Wow. When they rebuilt the north transept of the chapel, which had been demolished in 1590, they found under the soil some of these medieval armorial tiles. So they took up the floor and they relayed it with the least damage they could and filled in the gaps with the armorial tiles.
Who's responsible for the confusion in the patterns?
As you can see, some of them are broken. And there are broken fragments in the Bristol Museum.
Are much better conserved than the Renaissance ones.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. The superior quality of Moorish workmanship.
Mm-hmm. So you're admitting they are Islamic, or, you know, because they're coming from a Christian Spain.
They're coming from Christian Spain, but the Islamic influence in Christian Spain still existed for quite a long time after the change of rule. And it was a crossing over of cultures. It's happened in two or three different places in Europe.
It happens in what you call an entrecruje de culturas, a crossroad of cultures.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the same is true in architecture too, is it?
Oh, yes, definitely. There's a whole style of architecture in Spain called Mudéjar, and it is Islamic architecture, even of churches, but commissioned by Christian patrons. Because, as I said, the peasantry were just a bunch of ignorant louts. And on top of that, you had a military aristocracy who didn't have much culture either. So they had to employ the Muslims, down to the expulsion of 1609. And some people say that Islam still survives in Spain, but secretly. There are, of course, modern converts.
Like yourself.
I'm not Spanish. I was educated in Spain, but I was born in Scotland.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Carol Higgins, and I'm the author of Conquering the Impossible, Making the Dream Come True. I'm dyslexic. I got all U's at school. I got no qualifications, but I always had a dream to write a book to be able to tell my life story, because there's a certain message in there that I want a lot of people to hear.
Whereabouts are you, Carol?
I'm up in Yorkshire. I'm a Barnsley girl, but I've just moved a bit further, a few miles away from there. I'm in a village called Ackworth.
Okay, so tell us about your book and why is it so significant?
My book is significant because I wrote it for a charity called the Lily Millie Foundation, which is a charity really close to my heart. And they wanted a dozen people to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And I had two reasons for climbing that, because I was an adrenaline junkie. And like I just say, well, I am an adrenaline junkie. And like I say, the reason that the charity is close to my heart is because my sister was born with a severe disability and out of control epilepsy, and they sadly lost their daughter a day before her first birthday because of a life-threatening disability, and wanted to open a respite centre in the next village to me, called Hemsworth, in memory of her. So I started writing the book when I set off to Leeds Bradford Airport, by taking a diary with me and then taking it up the mountain. I'd never kept a diary before in my life, but I wrote all about my surroundings, you know, and the struggles of climbing the mountain, and also about my battle with cancer, because in the year I had to raise the £3,500 for the charity, on my birthday, the 23rd of April, I was diagnosed with bowel cancer and I had 9 hours of surgery. After the 9 hours of surgery, I came home, I continued fundraising, I started swimming in the pool, and 8 months later, I set off to do the climb, not knowing if I would be fit enough. And that's where I took the diary up there to write all about my journey. So I never gave up on my dream of conquering the biggest freestanding mountain in the world. And when I came back, I started writing it on the computer, all the notes. That became the blueprint to my book, my diary.
Okay, and then can we just go back to the cancer for a minute? I mean, for this is a touchy subject for a lot of people, but are there any warning signs, would you say, for, I mean, bowel cancer specifically? But, I mean, I try and do this whenever we get someone on who's had cancer, just so that people maybe could recognise it in its early, in its early stages.
Yeah, there are symptoms. The symptoms that I had was no pain whatsoever, even though I lied to the doctors after a year of them telling me that the blood that was coming from my backside was piles. And, you know, I agreed with them for so long. And then after a while, I said, this isn't right. I actually want to be tested for this. Finally, they agreed after a year of me going to the doctors, and they found that I did have dark blood in my faeces, and also on mucus. It's not a very attractive subject to talk about. So I rang the clinic to book a colonoscopy, and they said that we haven't got in, we've got you down here as not an emergency, so we've got an appointment in a few months' time. And this is where the lie came in. And I told them that I was in a lot of pain and that there was a lot more blood than there had been, and therefore I did consider it an emergency. So they got me in within 2 days at that point. I had the camera test, and while he was doing the test, I watched the procedure, and I said to him, that doesn't look very attractive. When he finished the procedure, he said to me, you know the part where you said didn't look very attractive? And I said, yes. He says, I'm sorry to tell you it's cancer. I don't even need to send the biopsies off, even though I'm going to. He says, but you need to be on the operating table within 2 weeks, because it's as big as big as an orange. And that's how I found out that I'd got cancer.
Okay, so there was never any pain. This sort of thing, it's obviously a good idea to get it nipped in the bud. So all I'd say to listeners is, Any hints of the sorts of symptoms that Carol's been describing, get down to the doctor straight away. Make a nuisance of yourself, especially the way the National Health Service is under attack at the moment with defunding. You need to make, just if necessary, go and sit in accident and emergency and don't go anywhere until they deal with you. Anyway, also, I know that you've been engaging a bit with the community up in Leeds who are looking at the child sexual abuse scandal, Carol. So how did that happen?
Not up in Leeds. I went up to Liverpool to do the independent inquiry into child sex abuse a few weeks ago. And that all started when I wrote my book. I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to backtrack a little bit for me to be able to explain that a little bit more, how that happened. I decided I wanted to write the name of my abuser, which was my father, who sexually abused me, thought it was his job to break his daughter in, and he groomed me and physically abused me and mentally abused me all my life from being a baby. And so when I wrote my book and before I published it, I said, that's it, his name's going in. My friend said, you can't do that, it's illegal. And I said, there's no point me writing this book if I don't name him. I've been asking the police to investigate my case for 34 years. When I was 15 years old, I went into the police station and made a 17-page statement. I went to Huddersfield Police Station.
Is that in Barnsley? That
was in Penistone, yes, in Penistone. I grew up in Denbighdale, so Barnsley and Huddersfield, they're the surrounding towns where I live.
And so what did the police do at that point?
The police at that point said, after I had my forensic internal tests done, I was jumping up and down. They had me on blotting paper, giving pubic hairs, internal samples, and I was internally bleeding. After they did them tests and I gave my statement, they came back to my mum's house 3 weeks after the test and said, we've been to your dad's house, we've checked his house, searched it, and there's no evidence to be found, so there's no case to be looked into, and left it. They've just left us no paperwork, nothing. They never took statements from my mum, my brother, neighbours, anybody.
So is your dad named in the book? Is he still alive?
He is still alive, and he still lives in the same village in the same house that he sexually abused me in, yes.
So it does sound a bit strange that you've made all these accusations to the police, you've even published it, and yet still there's been no proper inquiry, it seems, into your dad.
Well, I did launch my book 3 years ago, and I've been pushing it since then. I went to the police first in 1984, in 2005, in 2012, in 2014, and they closed the doors on me. I then went back in 2015 after naming him in book and launching it, and they tried to close the door on me again, saying CPS, it would be abuse of process, and there's no witnesses, even though we have some evidence that he raped you, you know, for us to open a case. So I've done my victim's right to review, and it has now gone back to CPS. It's with CPS now, and they are taking a proper look at it. But the police was refusing to take all the witnesses' evidence and make a proper investigation. I've had to fight tooth and nail for them, you know, to actually keep this case open.
Amazing, Carol. Look, what about, have you got any advice for people out there, either who know somebody or themselves have been sexually abused in the past, in the distant past? What advice would you have for them in actually trying to make, make charges and make charges stick? Because obviously the problem here is that it's like climbing a mountain, like climbing Kilimanjaro, really, to actually get the system to, as it's proved with the Jimmy Savile case, to actually do anything about a lot of these accusations. And I mean, we've seen this also, this scandal going on in the national political arena, as well as Harvey Weinstein's scandal. And you do wonder if maybe all we've seen so far is the tip of the iceberg.
We certainly have, and all this is about police protection, police protecting him, my dad. They are protecting him because of what he knows about the establishment's paedophile ring. He rented land off judges, off a judge, he rented land off detective inspectors from back in the day, or from 84, 85. And the advice I would give anybody is, firstly, two bits of advice, always report it and never give up. You know, never give up knocking on that door and never give up trying to get the support and advice that you can to keep moving and pushing forward. I have been in touch with my MP, with Police and Crimes Commissioner, Matt Burns-Williams, John Trickett, you know, and getting these people on side and making them aware that this is how I've been treated. I've got the police professional standards involved. You know, it's just about keep knocking on that door, you know, and not letting go. And like you rightly said, it's about conquering physical mountains and psychological mountains. My book, Conquering the Impossible, Making the Dream Come True. And with sheer guts and determination and willpower, it can be done. And I keep the faith in most things that I do. And I think that's the reason. And I've been shut down off Facebook now for the last 2 months because the establishment are controlling my page because they are doing everything to keep my case under wraps.
Interesting. Well, what about this network you talked about that your father was involved in? That's to me is the worrying thing, because if your father, as you say, is involved with people who are police officers, that really should have been disclosed. And if it wasn't disclosed at the time, and if those police officers didn't stand aside and allow the course of justice to just carry on as it should, these police officers are actually guilty of, or they could be guilty of what's called malfeasance. That is to say, misconduct in public office. Now, that is punishable with up to life in prison. So they have committed, if it's possible to say this, even a greater crime than your father has by not doing their job and by favouring him. So tell us a bit more about this network.
Yeah, perverting the course of justice. That's what you do. What I'm doing. And so coming back to the question about the inquiry in Liverpool, a lady contacted me who is part of that organisation and advised me to go and speak to them. And I spoke to the panel. My appointment was for 2 hours. I was there from 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and I told them about the paedophile ring. I then got a phone call from the police a few weeks later saying that they'd contacted them, because what happens when you go to the inquiry into child sexual sex abuse, they then passed your information on to the lawyers. The panel sent it on to the lawyers, and then the lawyers pass it on to Operation Hydrant, and then Operation Hydrant think if there's still anything to be investigated, pass it back on to West Yorkshire Police or the area that you live in. So then the police contacted me. I won't start naming names, even though I've got the recordings of all the lies and the cover-ups, you know, going back for the last 2 years. I record everything on my phone and an app on my phone, so I've got them, you know, telling me lies and bullying me and threatening me. They contacted me and said that they was happy that they'd investigated my dad's case. And I says, why would you be saying that when they know what stage I'm at with that, and that, you know, police have refused to prosecute him and now I've done my rights to review? Surely that's not right. That they haven't contacted you for that reason. And the reason really Operation Hydrant had contacted them was to say, have you investigated the paedophile ring that Carol is telling us about? And he turned around and says, I'm happy that we have. And I says, oh no, you have not. I've reported this to the two officers investigating my case, and they turned around and said to me, we are not investigating a paedophile ring, we are investigating your dad, and so we're happy that that's being dealt with. And I said, no. I said to the inspector, if you find out and start asking questions who the officers are that protected my dad, you will find out that you're dealing with corruption within the police force. And he said to me, I don't know how to pacify you anymore, Carol. Yes, certainly, if we find that out, then, you know, that will become visible, and we refuse to look into it.
So how have you got on with the media up in Yorkshire there? I would have thought that they would be interested in this, the newspapers, the radio, etc.
No, I've been... because of who he is, my father, and where he lives, a lot of the police have turned it round. They've got an harassment warning on me. They've took it to CPS. They're telling lies about that because I'm not harassing him. It was in the Huddersfield Examiner a few weeks ago that somebody's tried to burn his house down and done a lot of damage to his house and spray painted as a paedophile and smashed his windows and tried to burn his house down. And he's got cameras, and there's a picture of somebody running away. So they've put it spread on the front page of the Examiner saying, do you know who this person is? Because he's reported it. And when I rang them up to tell them why all this was happening to his house, why the public was doing this, they turned around and I said, I could, you know, tell you the reasons why. He says, no, I don't think we've got a story to tell, and put the phone down on me.
It's a shame, isn't it? Because it does sound like that's probably the reason, and because the police haven't been investigating properly, that may well be why this has happened. Anyway, Carol, more power to your elbow. I think it's important that you just keep on keeping on until there is a proper investigation, that this does potentially go through the Crown Prosecution Service, it goes to court.
Well, it's with them, and I've got a meeting with them tomorrow, and I'm fingers crossed, I'm quite certain now that, you know, this is going to go forward.
Is there any real prospect of police officers that have obstructed this case in the past might be arrested?
Well, I'm hoping so, because I have also got I'm dealing with three cases, an harassment charge against me. I've made official complaints about all the officers that have treated me like this. I've done a chronological order summary from 1984 to present day to how I've been treated. That has gone to Chief Constable D. Collins, my MP and Mark Burns-Williams, and certain officers. So there's that against the police for me to prosecute them, and there's also me prosecuting my father, who abused me.
And anywhere that people can follow you online? Because obviously we can't really trust the Yorkshire Press to be telling us what's going on, Carol.
Well, people can be looking on my Conquering the Impossible page, Carol Higgins, on Facebook. You can see what I'm doing, even though I can't post things on it. I've got enough posts on there for people to see. Please keep sharing. Please keep sharing worldwide as well, because he's trying to escape to New Zealand. Even though he's 17, he doesn't meet the criteria. The police are protecting him from that one.
Can you see why some people might think this is just a family squabble that's got out of hand?
Oh, yeah, I've had a few people say you couldn't write this story because it would seem too far-fetched, definitely. And you can also follow me on Twitter. I've just recently started learning that. My webpage, that's going to be updated, carolhiggins.co.uk. So, you know, you can see I give inspirational talks about my cancer, about my child, overcoming child sexual abuse. I give inspirational talks about to the youth service about skydiving, conquering mountains, you know, doing charity work. That's what I do a lot of. People think you've got to be rich to do a lot of the adrenaline junkie things that I do, but because I do it for charity, it's a win-win situation.
The other piece of advice I say is, don't rely on Facebook, it seems, because it looks like when it comes to something really important, Facebook is crashing and burning. But anyway, Carol Higgins, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Tony, anytime.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Yeah, I'm John Langley, and I am, I suppose, a political campaigner activist. I've stood for elections in the city. I have a lot to do with housing and homelessness. And I suppose quite... I wouldn't say anti Marvin, because actually Marvin is a very nice bloke, you know, a decent citizen and all the rest of it. But you know, I stood against him in the election campaign for elected mayor, which he won. Fair play, he won it. But I wouldn't have said he was the best candidate. Not saying that I was the best candidate, but I'm not saying he was the best candidate. And since then, I have no faith in Marvin being mayor of the city at all, and I just see things getting worse, not better.
Well, why? What's the problem? I mean, he's a Labour candidate, he's implementing Labour policies, surely.
No, he's a Labour candidate who's implementing Tory policies. That's the difference. Instead of, you know, if you go back to sort of the 1980s and Derek Hatton, when Labour were in power there...
Up in Liverpool.
Yeah, up in Liverpool, and Derek Hatton sort of took on the Tory government, won, and got 20 million quid out of it. Now, when you bear in mind that here we've got a Labour... council here in Bristol, there's one in Manchester, there's one in Birmingham, there's one in Liverpool. So if all the Labour authorities had got together and said to the government, no, we're not having any of this, the government would have probably crumbled or just given in. They'd have had to.
Actually, the government at the moment is pretty fragile anyway.
It is, and so it would have actually broken them.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, what do you make of Marvin and his family? Have you been digging into his past, I understand?
Well, I had a very interesting conversation, which it's quite random. I went into a shop in Bristol and I knew somebody who worked there and he said, oh, hi, Johnny, how are you doing? You know, what are you doing nowadays? And I said, you know, I'm still involved in politics and doing far more of that. And then somehow he got onto the road situation. And I don't quite remember that part of the conversation.
Was that about all the traffic lights? It was all that about traffic lights.
Yeah,
and all the it seems like they're breeding. Or
I know, but it was about. He said, if Marvin's dad comes down, he said he'd be absolutely furious at this. So at that point, my ears pricked up because he was suddenly talking about Marvin's father, and I hadn't prompted it in any way, shape, or form at all. He just mentioned it in the conversation, so I wanted to pry a little bit more in it. Into the background of what he was talking about without making it look as if I was being too interested, you see. So I said, oh, well, do you know Marvin's father? He said, oh, well, he knows my mother. They were, you know, they were friendly back in the day. And, you know, whenever Marvin's father pops down to Bristol, he calls in to see my mother and all the rest of it.
Okay, so this is Valentine, is his name, that right?
Yeah, Valentine Rees. And then he said, oh, he's still got his doves. Now, I heard that as D-U-B-S, as in dubs, as in music. So I didn't think anything more of it. I thought, well, if the guy's into dub music, you know, fair play. And then he said, a little later in the conversation, well, they're sacrificial. And I kind of took a sharp intake of breath and thought, well, how can dubs be sacrificial? And then he said, you know, the white doves. And it suddenly clicked that he was talking about, you know, flappy birds.
It's just pigeons, basically.
Yeah, basically. And he was alleging and saying, oh, yes, Marvin's father, he's into the old black magic stuff. And he had this import shop in London where he used to import goods and furniture from Africa and resell it. And in the back room, he had this sort of little black magic place where he used to sacrifice the doves.
Well, hang on a minute, because if you're importing stuff from Africa, you're probably going to be importing black magic things, bits and pieces. Yeah, yeah. That's normal, isn't it?
That would be normal. But it's the fact that he said, yes, the doves are sacrificial doves, and he gets them in and he cuts their throats or whatever he does with them and uses them for sacrificial purposes for his black magic. He said black magic.
Did he have any evidence? Did he proffer any evidence?
No. It was just the fact that he'd known Marvin for a number of years through his mother, who'd known Marvin for a number of years, and that Marvin, you know, I would think it is, you know, my estimate that his mother would have sort of told him stories about Marvin from the past and the fact that they knew one another. And when Marvin's father, Valentine Rees, comes into Bristol, he then goes, or they, you know, he connects with this guy's mother. So that's as far as it went. So, you know, there's no concrete proof of it, but this was the story that was related to me.
Amazing.
Allegedly.
Well, the other thing, of course, which is a dove connection, is that Valentine used to run this club called the Crystal Dove, I think it
Correct.
Was, on the front line.
Yes, which is now where, the community places in St. Paul's.
There's Malcolm X Centre.
No, it's the St. Paul's Community Centre. It's sort of on the other side of St. Paul's. So if you were coming down, if you like, off the motorway, and then there's the road sort of goes left and right, and then there's a park bit in the middle, and you go down there towards, as if you're going sort of, It's on the left hand. It's sort of St. Paul's Community. It's a community facility, and they've got a cafe and all the rest of it in there. And it's all actually
on
that.
Are you talking about the Learning Centre?
The Learning Centre, thank you. That's the one.
Right, because that was built on a piece of open ground, a park land. So it wouldn't have been there. So you're talking about a little bit further down Grosvenor Road from the Black and White, for example.
I mean, the research I've done online suggests that it was actually on that site where the Learning Centre now is.
Well, there was nothing on that site.
Well,
I can tell you.
I mean, even
when it was built, it was just grass.
But then I accept the
originally.
Fact. Yeah, and I accept the fact that that isn't the case. But that's what I gleaned myself.
Okay, so I mean, what do you read any significance into this allegation about Marvin's father and sacrificial doves? I mean, can you just explain how they might be used?
I've kind of not researched into how to sacrifice doves. I would imagine the blood perhaps is used in some sacrificial way, but you know, I'd need to go back and Google it really to see what actually the process is.
It's certainly an interesting idea, but I think Marvin doesn't tend to talk about his father for these reasons.
And I mean, anything at all.
I wonder, what their relationship is like. Are you saying he's seeing him from time to time still?
Well, whatever I say is going to be circumspect because I've only heard this from another party. I don't know what the relationship is, but what was related to me was the fact that he comes to Bristol possibly to see Marvin's mother, or because Marvin, as you say quite rightly, he never ever mentions his father at all. It's always about his mother. So whether there's any kind of history there between them, whether Valentine comes down to see the mother and other friends, I just don't know. But it's certainly an interesting story. And as you look at Marvin's father's past, more and more of it unravels to the history of him in St. Paul's, the status in the community, and the associations that he made at that time with other people.
Nana, who's over in Ghana, who used to be, he changed his name from Kumba Balagoon, he was saying quite clearly that Marvin's father was a real troublemaker. Basically, he was a police informer. I mean, is that normal, police informers all around St. Paul's, places like that? I suppose it is, really.
I would think it would have been at that time, yes. But that would need to be verified by somebody who was working in the police service at that time, who would know something about it. It wouldn't surprise me, because the story that I've looked into suggests connections with the IRA, various people having prison sentences, a bombing up in Northampton, I believe, a firebomb. So there's lots of stuff that goes around Valentine Rees's life, but we haven't sort of quite got the right jigsaw pieces in the right places to build the picture.
Nana is saying that he was totally convinced that that Marvin's dad was a police informer, that everyone he knew believed he was. And I just wonder, maybe it was much more to do with MI5 and the IRA, because of the IRA connection, I would imagine. The new Thatcher government in the 1980s would have been looking at anybody who had connections with the IRA.
Yeah, and they would have done.
And Sinn Féin, specifically Sinn Féin, yeah. And Gerry Adams,
yeah.
That they would decide that maybe that wasn't a good idea to have a connection between Irish Republicans and Bristol black activists.
Mm.
Especially Bristol black activists who had firebombed police stations. And this one, well, not police stations, but what this particular one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when you go back into the history of Bristol, the fact that, bombings around Bristol as well at that time, it's hardly surprising that the IRA, having or being here on the mainland at that time, wouldn't want to connect with other activist group to garner their support in some way, to strengthen their cause. So it suggests a kind of a deal between the IRA being here and then associating themselves with other strong activist groups who would also participate or certainly engage in quasi-IRA activity.
Is it understandable, do you think, that MI5 would want Marvin's dad to intervene and get community civil rights activists out of the city?
It is, well, everything is circumspect, but it is quite possible, yes.
All right, John, anything else you'd like to say?
No, that's it.
All right, thanks very much. That's all for this week. Dialects of Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And you can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Jakob Zeki and Marek Barden, the verger at the Lord Mayor's Chapel. Also to the brave Carol Higgins from Barnsley. And John Langley, the mayoral candidate and campaigner for housing here in Bristol. and also to studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain through the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
I'm Peter Perennius, and we're at Cumbisset on the banks of the River Ebble.
Tell me about the condition of the river this year.
It is more discoloured than I have ever seen it during any May in the whole of my 60 years that I've known the Ebble. I'm 72 and I've fished the Ebble for over 60 years. Generally, at this time of year, it will be running crystal clear with great banks of water buttercup weed, beds of very clear gravel, and masses of trout rising in the channels between the weed. As we look at it now, we can see it is a sort of murky brownish grey colour. There's hardly any growing ranunculus. There's certainly no fish rising whatever, and this should be the height of the trout fishing season, when there should be fish rising everywhere. There are a number of factors which have contributed to the decline of our chalk streams. First and foremost, undoubtedly, the low rainfall that we've experienced for the last 5 years. The long-term average has not been reached for the last 5 years. And that's absolutely exceptional. It very often happens that long-term average is not reached for 1 or 2 years, but then it's always made up by 1 or 2 years of above long-term average rainfall. But what we've had in the last 5 years has been a consistent below long-term average rainfall. This has caused the aquifers to become depleted, the underground sources of the water which feed all these chalk streams, and our rivers are running incredibly low for the time of year. In a change in wildlife since when I first came to the Ebble Valley for my holidays in 1929-1930 onwards is absolutely phenomenal. We used to hear every evening a bird called the curlew. That usually presaged rain, and practically every evening you had rain promised by the song of the curlew, and it arrived the next day. I have not heard a curlew in this valley for over 30 years now. It has completely disappeared. We used to have immense flocks of plover, the green plover, sometimes known as the peewit, I think is its popular name. These are almost non-existent now in this valley. We get a few of them, but there used to be thousands, and now there are probably dozens where there used to be thousands. Now, the reason for those changes is the change in agricultural use of the land. When I was a child, they used to have what they called hatches, little adjustable dams, every quarter of a mile, all the way down the river. These hatches were used to raise the water level in the early spring, and
just to hold the river back?
To raise the water level in order to be able to divert the river all over the fields in the little side ditches, which were called carriers, for carrying water all over the fields.
Now, interestingly enough, you're trying a similar sort of experiment yourself here, where you've placed a weir in the river just at the back of your house, and you're diverting the river over a space of something like 15, 20 yards, quite a distance over into the old water meadows here.
The purpose of this is to raise the soil moisture density in this little meadow way in, and to try to restore the whole environment to the type of environment we had 30 or 40 years ago. I remember some of these old Wiltshire characters that impressed me so much as a small boy. I was born in London, spent most of my life in towns, but every summer we came down here, and I was immensely impressed by the way the labourers used to talk about their experiences. I remember there was a man who did some gardening for my mother, and she complained to him, "You know, those blackbirds, they're doing an awful lot of harm. They're eating all our soft fruit up." And he replied, "Mum, in my opinion, it's two-legged birds that are taking them fruits." Of course, he meant thieves. So that was one of our favourite phrases. He was a great gossiper, that gardener, and I can still see him in my mind's eye leaning on his fork and saying, "Well, there's some people in the villages I shouldn't like to mention. For instance, there's old Mrs. So-and-so," and then up would come some scandalous piece of gossip. In fact, it always became a phrase in our family, "some people as I shouldn't like to mention." He always mentioned them immediately after he said he wouldn't like to mention them. The Ebble Valley is famous for being a place where one lady who wanted to be alone lived for considerable periods just after the war, and that was Greta Garbo, who lived somewhere up around Broadchalk, if I remember rightly. I must say I never met her because she was a lady who wanted to be alone, but it certainly must have suited anyone who was of a solitary disposition, particularly in those days. There was hardly anyone in the Ebble Valley apart from the local people. In the Wiltshire streams, most of the fish will take bread.
So does that mean that folk can just wander down by the side of the river and flick bread in like they would feed for the trout, like they would feed the ducks?
Yes, as long as the pieces of bread are not too large, it will almost certainly bring trout up if there are any trout around. And most of the village boys know this perfectly well, actually, and get very unpopular with the fishermen as a result.
Why is that unpopular with the fishermen? Surely it's nothing wrong with just feeding the trout.
Oh, feeding them is all right, but when you feed them with hook attached, it's a different story, isn't it?